So, we're gonna kick off the sort of blocks five and six, or six and seven, or
Five and
five and
six.
six this week. So, this one will be the kickoff for basically block six, and I'll be talking about some basic open questions and challenges from jet substructure standpoint. So just as a quick outline, so I apologize that I'm not doing this on the blackboard, but as I tell my students, you wouldn't be able to read it if I did. So I'll just have some relatively light slides, and we'll, predominantly be open for discussion pretty much the entire time. So the outline of the talk will be that I will have a very brief primer for the few of you that are maybe not familiar with this area. Then I'll give you some non-comprehensive lists of work that's basically there for a reading list and to set the stage of basically the directions that I think we should perhaps be going. So I'll be mostly talking about a very few recent papers that I like that are giving some, I don't know, some information that I think is important. All these errors and views, any views and any errors are mine, of course, and please, this is mostly for discussion, so this is not to be taken as too much in concrete, and mostly I'm just trying to get a dialogue started. So in 60 seconds, I can tell you how, so basically for boosted objects, if you just take a particle that decays into two other ones, and assuming that the two other ones are light compared to the big one, you can relate the angle between the two particles that are outgoing to the energy and the mass of the incoming particle. And if you just do the math very quickly, you see that the angle between them will go like 2 over gamma. So as you get more highly boosted, the angle decreases, and now you can show all your friends the math that goes through here. So when you ask, how boosted will these be? You just divide 2 over gamma, and that'll be the angle that you need. So you too can calculate boosted stuff in your head. Why this is hard, however, is because if you take any traditional sort of jet clustering algorithm, it fixes theta at some value, and so therefore, if you fix theta and you take multiply, or you cross multiply the theta and gamma, you see that you've actually applied a maximum energy cut, which is a problem, and so that's no good, and so you need something that's not a fixed theta, and that's where the jet substructure comes in. So jet substructure and grooming, just in general, in 60 seconds, can be basically shown here. So the general gist is to try to remove the soft part of the jets and retain the hard core. There's many examples on the market, and a few of the more popular ones are here. So trimming, filtering, and pruning have different strategies for doing this. There's a new one called soft drop, which I'll come back to later. The idea is to look inside any jet. So if you take the trimming algorithm, for instance, you take a jet, you recluster with small r, and then you remove some of the stuff that you're not interested in. And in the case of trimming, you remove the ones that have a soft PT relative to the main jet. And then whatever's left over is your hard jet. Okay, so similar things can happen for filtering and pruning. I don't want to go into the details of how this works, but basically it's effectively, feels like the same thing, and the differences are in the details. So recently, this new soft drop algorithm has been developed, and this is kind of nice. There are two parameters, three parameters, but one drops out basically for this algorithm. If you take any clustering and you look at the minimum of the PTs divided by their sum, and you require that each step in the clustering has to be larger than some z cut times the angle divided by some parameter raised to the power beta. So usually r is taken to be the same size as the actual jet cluster, the original jet clustering algorithm, so this doesn't really matter all that much, and you basically end up picking z cut and beta. So what this actually means is that if you look at sort of a distribution of the number of jets, so this is rho over sigma times d sigma d rho, where rho is the mass squared over PT squared, scaled by r. Okay? So that quantity goes from 0 to 1, And if you look at this is actually a calculation that's been done recently by Gregory and company. If you actually take a look at this, the plane jet mass is here in red, and you can see that you have your pseudocop peak here, and then you have your fall off as you get to high rho, which means to high mass for a given fixed PT. And you can see the effect of the various groomers. And so what they really are trying to do is take the pseudocop peak and suppress it as much as possible. Okay. So the differences in the various algorithms, so trimming is here in red and the pruning is here in green, this modified mass drop tagger is actually equivalent to this soft drop algorithm if beta is equal to zero. But you can see that they will reproduce the jet mass from standard jets for some period. Then you get to this period here, this inflection point, which is 0.1, set by this parameter z-cut. Okay? After that, the Pseudocop peak gets suppressed. However, the details of which algorithm you're using will tell you if there's another inflection point or not. Okay? So there's another inflection point for trimming, and there's another inflection point for pruning. For the modified mass drop tagger / soft drop, there's no other inflection point. It's flat below this z-cut value. The Pseudocop peak is suppressed, and you're dropping all the soft parts of the jet in a very controlled way. So I'm going to come back to this picture later, but bear this in mind. Okay, that's the end of the primer. Maybe it was slightly more than 120 seconds, but are there questions? Everybody's with me. Good. Okay, so run two is upon us, and I think we're already up to something like 120 inverse picobarns as of today-ish. 500? Oh man, I'm way out of touch. What's wrong with me? Okay, so basically, just to give you an idea, so the cross sections that you get in terms of even standard model processes going from say 8 TeV to 13 TeV, effectively you'll get 2.5 times more higher fraction, for instance, of even standard model boosted tops. So this is not necessarily only important for searches. This is actually even becoming somewhat important for standard model measurements. Just to give you an idea of the numbers that we're looking at. So basically, there's about 800,000 tops in one inverse femtobarn at 13 dB, and something like 10,000 boosted tops out of those 800,000. Okay.
What do you mean boosted dB?
This is above 400 GV. So the list of topics that are going, this is basically just a reading list. I would never be able to get through everything in minutes. And so instead, I will just give you the list if you're interested. And then there, I've stolen this slide from Gavin, where we have basically where he's kind of shown the clustering of clustering algorithms, judged based on history. There's three basic main, areas that were occurring in about 2013. So there's basically things that are from jet clustering, a bunch of techniques that are from jet clustering. Some things are that are basically from matrix element hypothesis testing, and then there's standard jet shapes. This grew into a very large number of things, and there's various techniques that you can use here. I don't want to go into the details here, but basically, for the most part, you're looking at things that are using the clustering in order to understand the substructure. And also, the hypothesis testing will play a strong role here. I'll talk about a couple of these in detail in a couple of minutes. And coupling these with jet shapes gives us basically the suite of handles that we had in about 2013. Fast forward to 2015, and I would say that there was a huge amount of theoretical work that went into the field. And so I would actually add an entirely new, category, which is analytics. And there were calculations about the mass, there's calculations about N sub jettiness, there's calculations about angularities, and this soft drop algorithm that I alluded to sort of came out of this more theoretical understanding. And so if you go back to this picture, it was really the guiding principle here is that this Pseudocop suppression is very, very smooth and very well understandable. For the soft drop algorithm, and I think this drove the field for a couple of years. this is basically where we were about last year, and in this year, there's a couple of things that I want to talk about that have come up recently. One is a very brand new approach here, which is to use data science in order to understand and see if there's any information that can be gleaned that we haven't already exploited. And I'll talk about this in a little bit. And I'll also talk about the sort of marriage of the sort of analytics that we're trying to, and basically some idea of the jet clustering in order to see if there's any way to push the wall out of performance to see where we can grow as a field in the future. So I'll be primarily focusing on recent developments. Just to catch you up to speed, there is an enormous cottage industry of how this looking at the performance of these kinds of various things, and you could probably count a graduate student for every one of the lines in every one of these tables, pretty close. So we have top identifying, boosted tops, identifying boosted WZs and Higgses on both CMS and Atlas. This has obviously been deployed in many, many searches, many measurements, lots of different places. But you're immediately looking at these and saying, well, what do I do with all this information? These are all so-called rock curves. These are receiver operating curves. It's an old 1950s terminology for basically looking at something's performance of how efficient it is versus how much background it lets in. There's various ways to measure the background rate. You can either measure how often it gets something wrong or how often it rejects the background. And so these are not, the y-axes are not exactly comparable. But basically you want to be, I'll just pick this one from CMS for the W tagging, for instance. Being as close down to the 100% efficient and zero background efficiency is where you want to be. So you want to be as far to this direction as is humanly possible. So you can see these are basically single variables of various flavors, and you can see that you want to be, you would say, well, these are the best over these, effectively. Now, there are other handles that you can have. So this is basically looking at sort of just the jet information, but I don't want to just focus on jets for this week, I would say. I think there's also things that we can do for leptons and even for bottom quarks. So for bottom quarks, you can also look, there are a number of experimental challenges when you have boosted B tagging, so something that's within a B that's within another boosted jet. Obviously, this has predominantly applications in boosted top and boosted Higgs analyses, but there are other SUSY analyses that this plays a strong role in as well. But I think we should make sure that we're aware of all of these kind of handles that are sort of orthogonal to the substructure-y kinds of things where you can win a lot. So even if you're not using the absolute best top tagger, if you're looking at these performance curves, maybe you're not using the absolute best one if you're only looking at that information. But if you add the B tag, a lot of the information gets subsumed, and it doesn't matter in the end. Okay. So what this will actually, what we'll actually see, and I'll talk about this in a little while, it's not necessarily just the case that you want the most, the best performant thing in Monte Carlo. You want the best performant thing in your analysis. So it does. If you're doing something that's so complicated you can't understand what you're doing, it doesn't help you, and it actually can hurt you in the end. So I think this is the next step that I think we need to start thinking about, much more understanding of this on a systematic level than we have in the past. In addition to bottom quarks and jets in general, I think the whole idea of boosted leptons was originally popular with people, then it kind of fell out of popularity and then came back into popularity again. I would say that there was lots of applications that we could think about here. So things that are, the moral of the story is trying to identify W's or Z's. And in this case, you would, traditionally, obviously, we use isolation, but isolation is a boost-dependent idea, right? So you need to have something that as you go back to this simple picture of 2 over gamma, you have to have something that will make sure that you're not putting another maximum energy cut because many of our isolation cones are fixed. So the exact same thing happens from jets and from leptons. So you have to be careful that you're not shooting yourself in the foot and removing part of your signal by placing this maximum energy cut, even with leptons. So this is important even for boosted Zs, for instance, as your two leptons get closer and closer together. So I think this is, you know, this is mostly to prove a point because, you know, obviously if you're just looking at Z to mu mu, it's relatively easy to fix the isolation cone. You just remove the other the muon and fix everything. One thing where it's not completely obvious is in the case of boosted taus. Okay, so you have something hadronic-ish looking and it has maybe three prongs, and then you have another one that's right next to it, maybe a boosted Higgs to tau tau event. This is, we're starting to think about these ideas. There's a CMS analysis that's been using boosted taus. And there's a couple of other ideas about how to address this in the experiments and in the theory community. So I think this is also another area where we may want to think about putting some effort and some discussion this week. So one thing I also like is this so-called lepton subject fraction. So this is just, you know, ignoring the idea, just completely giving up on the idea of isolation altogether, and you just sort of take the lepton and you assume that it has some clustering. You put it into the clustering algorithm and you don't care what it is. And at the end of the day, you pull out the fraction of the lepton, or the fraction of the subjet's energy that's carried by the lepton, and you can see that this actually can get pretty darn good performance right away. And so you don't even have to worry about isolation. So this is kind of a new approach, new idea of how to do things. I think we can, in principle, you know, make some use of this as a community a little bit more than we already been having. But these are other crazy ideas that are encouraged here.
This is for electrons?
This one is for either muons or electrons, this particular paper.
So I'm confused by the red. I would have expected the fragmentation, the hard fragmentation, to push it farther up to peaking at point one.
For the BB bar case?
What am I missing?
The hard fragmentation.
I would have expected something like 0.3.
Something like 0.3. Between 0.1 to 0.3. I don't know if I could get quite to that fine of detail. I have to remember, I recall the paper, but it's...
Where did it come from?
This came from this lepton subject fraction paper here.
All right, what kind of physics is
that? Oh, that's just BB, standard BB bar where you have a lepton in it.
It's a lepton from the BB.
Yeah.
With what PP?
Actually, this is the detail. Never mind.
It's a little bit.
Maybe matters. It may be a lepton from the charm, right? If this is a lepton in that jet,
yeah,
it may not be from the BDK, and that will shift it down.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's true. This is inclusive. So it's everything that's there. So yeah, I guess it's averaged between 0.1 and 0.3. Anyway, but you can, you know, you can see that clearly for the cases where you have, say, a boosted Higgs or a boosted top or something where you have some lepton that's inside of this thing, you can really see a very clear discrimination between sort of QCD-like events and, you know, TT bar-like events or something else where there's a, you know, hard W and on-shell W that's near a jet. Okay. Anyway, so the idea is to make sure that this session is not only about substructure, it's also about just in general boosted objects, so let's not forget our friends over here. In terms of applications of all this stuff, I mean, I don't even have time to list them. It'll take me too long. This is actually just the analyses that were ready with 13 TeV data in the last year, and I can't even fit them all on the page. There's all sorts of ways there's a huge number of things that have been done and a huge number of things that have not been done that we can probably think about doing. But the two questions that I really want to focus on are basically, are we doing the best we can in all of these applications, and are we doing as well as we think we're doing? Those are two somewhat separate questions. The first one is basically, are we doing the best we can? So effectively, if you'll recall these rock curves, so this is, for instance, the top tagging efficiency now. I showed you this plot a few slides ago, versus the background rejection. So you want good background rejection and high signal efficiency. So you want to be as close to this corner as is humanly possible. This is for various, this is a plot from Atlas. These are various taggers. One that I want to bring your attention to is Dave's beautiful paper about shower deconstruction here. And so this is trying to make maximal use of, excuse me, of QCD information in order to identify the shower correctly. Okay, so Dave can give way more information about this than I can. But basically, the moral of the story is using the most amount of QCD information that you can have gives you the best performance over any other variable that you can find. Okay, so this is the first kind of point that I think is important, that using the theory-based understanding gives you the most amount of information as possible. Okay, point number one. You can go the other route. And
so in that plot, that particular technique does not go to higher efficiency?
In this particular, actually, this is because I think this is a limited PT range. And you can have migration into and out of bins, but one of my Atlas colleagues can probably, maybe you know the answer better than I do, actually.
You can change the efficiency you want.
Yeah. So the Atlas working point that they have is this black point here.
I guess I'm missing.
You mean how going down this way?
Yeah, sorry.
The blue is this is it's a little hard to see. It's actually unfortunate. This is a dotted line here, which is the shower deconstruction, but it gets eaten by this blue one. It just overlaps, which is a different dagger.
Okay, simply that those points were not attempted.
I think they were just not attempted. But again, this is also in a limited PT range, so you have to dial the PT in order to get in other ranges as well. You have migration in and out of PT bins, because if you're looking for something that's more massive, for instance, you might push yourself into a different PT bin.
So your point is that this shower deconstruction is the best you could possibly do, and then that this W tagger does as well as the shower deconstruction?
Well, the point is that this is only for us. Most of these are sort of single variables. So if you're looking at a sort of a single variable, there, you know, the moral of the story is the more theory information that you put in, the better the information that comes out.
But you seem to be showing that the single variable does as well as the shower deconstruction, which is not a single variable.
The single variable, this is I think the tau 3-2 variable, right?
That's a complicated.
Yeah, this is not a single variable.
This
is their W prime tagger, which is not only tau 3-2. There's a couple of other cuts.
But either way, is the lesson that these multivariate taggers do as well as shower deconstruction?
I'll get into the multivariate ones in a second. But the point I was trying to make here is that you can get basically a single, you know, the best single variable that you can look at is this shower deconstruction tie variable, basically. I'll get into the MBAs in a second. Okay, so going on to MBAs. So I would say that these are exactly opposite approaches in some sense. So in the previous one, you're trying to use as much theory as humanly possible. There has also been approaches to use as little theory as humanly possible. Just throw this into a deep learning algorithm and let Skynet figure out, you know, what the answer is. So these are some recent papers. So basically, they're treating the entire event as an image, and there is a lot of technology and literature based on sort of machine learning of images lately, and people do this all the time. And so this is, facial reconstruction is driving this technology, but we can use this for discrimination here, and we can try to figure out what the various bits and pieces are supposed to be just by letting the machine, you know, the machine learn it on its own, okay? So this sort of gives you, you know, exploits every possible correlation, every possible piece of information that you can get. This is what it's trying to exploit. I think, you know, trying to use as few expert variables is what they call them, which is under the BDT, expert name. So these are basically anything that's sort of motivated by QCD or by theory or by anything like this. Or you can have the neural network sort of just figure it out itself. So these are two different approaches to kind of the same kind of idea. If you take a look at this one on the top, this has signal efficiency versus background rejection. So again, you want to be out to the upper right-hand corner here. If you take a look at the MBA constructed by our best guess at all the theoretical variables that you can use, you can look at the neural network that it learned itself, and they're basically on top of each other. There's a slight improvement, but they're basically on top of each other. So what does that mean? What do you take away from this?
Are those real curves or not just impressionistic? Those curves?
These are real curves. These are from this paper. Okay. These are from, I think this is Daniels and this is Ariel's. I can't remember which one. They're both of them are listed here, but I forget which one is which. They're ordered correctly. Yeah, so top and bottom. So what you can actually try to do is figure out what the learner is learning. Okay, so what is the information that's being pulled out here? So in the second paper here, what they actually did is they took WJETs, they averaged over many of them. They oriented the leading subject at 0, 0 and the other subject along the y-axis. Okay, and so these two little lumps here are what you're going to get from substructure algorithms that are sort of too prongy, like subjectiness or something like this. And what they did was they sort of looked at what the image, what features in the image were being extracted by the neural network in order to distinguish from the background. And so what they found is that if you do this, you can get another little bit of information that's effectively the radiation profile in between the two prongs. Okay, so Matt and Jason actually figured this out in 2010 already. And so with this so-called jet pull. So if you're giving information to the deep learning algorithm, if you had given this information to the deep learning algorithm which the authors did not try, I think the basis set of things that you could use would include this as well as a couple of other things. So I think if you look at sort of a spanning space of all possible taggers, it looks like that the neural networks are telling you that the basics, there are sort of three basis vectors. One is the jet mass. Another is some kind of pronginess or angularity basically the two things that are exploited by Shower deconstruction. And then there's also the radiation within the subjects, and it's sort of a diffuse background to the actual image itself. And so it seems like those are the three pieces of information that the neural network can pull out. However, most of the other things that you can try are more or less effectively spanned by these three pieces of information. Okay, so if you try to come up with some new clever variable, it will almost certainly, judging from the current experience and what the data deep learning algorithms are telling you, it'll probably perform as about the same as if you had given it these three. Okay, so that's, yeah.
Just a question, so I don't get confused. When you're talking about data, is it simulated data?
It's simulated. This is just the data analytics from this. Data as in data science. Yeah. So the deep learning kind of situations. So I think this is an important finding because I think.
Well, another question about that. Now that I know what you're talking about. Are you also saying so that was something that had come out of the deep learning. If you had started with that as an input, like you said, is it your conclusion that the performance would have been the same, or could you do better by feeding it more information to start
with? So with the deep learning, you've given it every piece of information that you have available to yourself. That's in terms of the jet clustering itself. So that's the goal of the deep learning, is that it'll extract every feature automatically.
Basically, by that you mean that the individual cells of the calorimeter were basically given.
Exactly. So you go over event, images that look like this for every different event, and you just keep feeding them to the neural network.
You have the energy in every single pixel.
Yes.
So then one more question is, how much longer does it take to do the deep learning approach than the guided?
That's a good. I don't know that. I don't know the answer. They're typically, typically what ends up happening is you just have to train these things. I mean, in general, MBAs take a while to train, and then when you're using them, it's just a calculation. It's no slower than a clustering algorithm, let's say. So you're just doing a bunch of activations and inner neurons and things like this. And Andy's nodding because I think he's done this in his life.
It's really fast to calculate.
It's fast to calculate.
I guess the question was the first learning. versus the training. Is it going faster? I didn't even guess that the maybe the deep learning is slower.
Anybody done this before? I've never done this myself. It's not dramatically slow. Let's put it that way. Where was I? Okay, so I think this is an important finding, not necessarily because you could, you know, give yourself up to our robotic overlords just yet, but certainly I think the information is that we're reaching sort of the point of diminishing returns in terms of clever variables we can use in order to do discrimination. I think that's an important piece of information that we've only learned in the recent past. So maybe it's important to try to, but it does look like what you expect from first principles QCD is what's giving you the best performance. And there's no magic weird thing that's occurring down deep in the levels of things that is doing some trickery we don't know about.
Are there some variables that are really badly modeled in simulation?
Yes.
And does that matter?
I'll talk about that in a second.
Oh, okay.
I'll talk about that general class of problems in a second.
Okay. I mean, that's related to my question before. I mean, so we should also ask what the actual data is telling us.
I gotta pay you guys later. Okay. So now this goes to the second question. So the first question was, are we doing the best we can? I think the answer is kind of yes. Okay, we're extracting as much information as possible out of this. This of course is my personal opinion. Feel free to disagree. But the other question that you can ask is, and generally this falls under the second question, you know, guideline. Are we sort of doing as well as we think we're doing? So if we give this the neural network, is the neural network going to give you what you think that you're getting out of it? So basically, we've been kind of obsessed with this performance level stuff, and we say in the simulation, everything looks great. But what happens in the actual data? And what happens, you know, more generally, how do you estimate systematic uncertainties here? I think it's important to turn back to the analytics here, and I think this is where can be gained, I'd say, from the experimental community using these more recent theoretical advances. So I think we're really coming, these communities are really merging together. So if you take a look at simulated, so this is the same plot that I showed you earlier of this jet mass over PT. This is the calculation. This is the simulation. You'll notice that actually one of the simulations is off, the trimmer here, which is shown in blue. It turns out that actually was a bug in Pythia that the authors figured out because they looked at this and said, well, it doesn't agree, but everything else agrees. They went back to the Pythia authors and they said, oh yeah, you're right, there's a bug. And so it got fixed and went back down. So one, the analytics actually calculated figured out a priori a bug in the event generators. So that's good. But another piece of information is that, you know, I'll just go with the guiding principle that smooth is and simple are better. Okay, so that's always the case for experimentalists. Something is smooth, we're smart enough to fit to a line. Yes. Anything beyond that, it's kind of debatable. but we're good with lines. So you can see a line here, but you can't. And there's a hump here which has a Surikov peak. This turns into a line. This turns into a line for a little while, but then actually has another peak here. So I think the answer is that something that's simple and understandable is going to end up being better in terms of systematics. Okay, and so now I think that's my next topic that I really want to talk about is how do you really estimate the systematic uncertainties here? And in general, you know, if you have, say, a neural network that gives you crazy variables and says you should be doing this, how are the data actually, you know, how well does it represent the data, and how well does the systematics, how do the systematics get impacted by this? Okay.
Quick question about the Pythia bug.
Yeah.
I assume the bug fix is in.
Oh, this is years ago. Yeah, this was 2013, I think, or 2012.
Only in 8, or is it in 6?
It was in 6 only.
The bug was in 6 or the fix was in 6?
The bug was in Pythia 6 and now the fix is also in Pythia 6. this is just Pythia 6 pointer. There's no bug in Pythia 8. There was some angularity mismatch. So I think some more angular ordering mismatch or something with the list of particles in the shower.
Could clarify something. I mean, you're emphasizing a lot that this modified mass drop or the mass drop tagger, the fact that it's a line is important for its kind of preferred analytic properties. But it's not really the fact that it's a line. If you had beta not equal to zero for a soft drop,
it's still a line.
It has a Zhdukov peak. I mean, it has double log.
Yeah.
But it's still under better out of control. And it's really because of the complete removal of soft radiation that makes it really determined by linear physics.
That's right.
And even if there's soft linear physics determining this double log, it's still all contained within the jet.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm trying to say that it's something. If it's flat, the experimentalist can play tricks. So I'm going to get to that in 1 second. But absolutely, that this is the real key here is the theoretical control of what you're dropping is the real important thing in terms of, you know, getting this to from starting point to finish. But I think this can also help us to address the systematic uncertainties.
I don't have a good sense how you read this plot, right? So
okay.
you don't want these Sudakov logs, you get a peak. What does that translate into? What does it mean in terms of an analysis?
Okay, so
if you were to use a trimmer, what does it mean in practice for your W-tagged jet?
So if you looked at the actual mass, not the rho variable, what ends up happening is that you usually will have something for the soft drop that looks like this. If you look at trimming, there will be a slight Sudakov peak, and then it may look like this. And the general mass would look maybe like this. Okay, so you would have plain trimmed and soft drop.
And that's for one particular PT.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to talk about that in 1 second. Okay, so if you actually look at, say, the soft drop mass, so this is the soft drop mass, and now I actually start making selections on, say, the tau 2 over tau 1 and some jettiness variables in order to do my W tagging. So this is the biggest question.
What is that plot?
I'm explaining this in 1 second. So this is what I just drew. What I just drew here. So this is the soft drop mass, not the rho.
All of
what?
What are the different lines?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that in a second. So let's say I take the soft drop mass, which is the curve at the top. Is this a pen? It is. Okay, so the curve at the top is this. Battery is dead. Not a pen. Okay. So what you're actually doing here.
Over in the corner there.
Yeah, I could point over here. So what I've done here is now I take my stick in the corner. Oh yeah, there we go.
A real point.
Now I have a weapon, so you got to be careful. So this is the soft drop mass that I was just talking about. Now let's say I want to apply it, make a W tagger. So what I'm going to do is cut on the N sub jettiness, and I start cutting on N sub jettiness, tau 2 over tau 1 cuts. The various lines are the successive tau 2 1 cuts. And so as you increase the tau 2 1, you start going down this distribution.
And these are QCD jets.
These are QCD jets. So what you can actually see is that the mass distribution starts to get sculpted by tau 2 1 because they're very highly correlated. Okay? And so if you're looking to keep this flatness behavior, it gets somewhat spoiled when you're using when you're looking at jet shapes, for instance. However, if you actually, we know the correlations that are there, basically, that they're effectively kind of linear. And so if you do a linear transformation and to transform tau to remove that correlation, you can actually preserve the kind of behavior in the soft drop mass. You can preserve the discrimination power, but the backgrounds are still very flat. Okay? And so this is from, so you wouldn't necessarily know this, unless you were doing the calculations here and you could see this, you know, you really expect this to be flat for soft drop, and then as you imply these angularities and or, you know, and so jettiness cuts, this starts to drop off, but that's because there's a linear correlation that you can actually just take out. So if you take this linear correlation out, things become much, much flatter. And so you don't see this shoulder here. Now, what can you do with this? So for an example. So let's say you take a W analysis. So you take maybe the diboson analysis at 2TeV for a benchmark. Okay? So you can just look at the WW search over the background. So you have some graviton or whatever to WW that's being discriminated against QCD jets. What you can actually see is that if you take the variables that you understand, which is the mass and this n sub jettiness variable, if you take a look at what the search would be, is basically a if you look at the jet mass, for instance, this red curve here would be the background component. This purple here is the signal component, and you're fitting them simultaneously. So this red, this blue band here is the uncertainty that you get on the normalization of each individual bin. Okay? But if you actually utilize the information that you got from the analytics, where this is as flat as is humanly possible, and you retain this flatness by decorrelating your variable with your mass, you can actually improve this by a significant amount. So the background uncertainty here is something like 23%. If you use the theory, this becomes much flatter, and now the background uncertainty is only 6%. Okay? So this is an example of something that you can, that it may not only be the case that you want to just look at discrimination power in order to decide which one is better. You may actually want to understand what the systematics are doing. But if you're going to understand what the systematics are doing, you really need the input from theory. Okay? So this is basically one example of taking the new technology that was developed from sort of a priori ideas and from looking at something that's theoretically well controlled. And as Matt was saying, once you have this soft physics that you can control in a very understandable way, you can start playing games. And it has real effects in the analysis. Is that a question, or are you just stretching?
Yeah, no, I have a question. What is actually plotted here? Is this simulated data? Simulated data where you're plotting some background, QCD background, and also superposing on it some kind of
W signal from a boosted W at 2TV, or a boosted W from a resonance at 2TV. So these are 1TV Ws. Okay? So what you can see, I mean, the important thing is that this Sudikoff peak that's coming from something that has high mass is not, what you want this to be suppressed is as much as is humanly possible. But even still, if you don't choose your kinematic variables correctly, you will introduce features that may actually spoil your analysis, even if you've come up with something that's a priori really nice in terms of your Monte Carlo performance. But it doesn't take into account any systematics, and you may actually be screwing yourself.
What's driving the very large systematics with the large?
Mostly because you can't. It's hard to to fit. So this is a model of a Gaussian background with a Gaussian signal, and it's hard to distinguish between the two bits because the sidebands are basically underneath the signal. So you have this one, this broad peak that's underlying a narrow one. If the broad peak is very broad or close to flat, the actual fit can understand what's going on much better. And so this is actually what the experiments end up doing for the theoretical uncertainties or for the searches. And you can see the theoretical uncertainties get significantly reduced just from the fitting. Yeah.
So I'm sorry for being slow, but is it true that what this is really doing on the previous page is you're taking from the left plot to the right plot, you know there's a PT dependence to the mass, the shape of the mass in the background.
Exactly.
And you're applying this PT dependence.
Effectively, yes.
Is there more to it than just the PT dependence of the mass?
No. Well, it's not exactly, actually, because it's not just the mass, because it's the mass correlated with this tau 2-1 variable. So this tau 2-1 variable is correlated with the mass. Both of them are correlated with the PT.
Oh, because you also have a cut on tau 2-1.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you do this tau 2-1 cut, and it starts to sculpt from flattish to not flat at all.
That's actually where the PT dependence is coming
right
from. It's the efficiency that cut is sculpting your mass.
Exactly. But if you look at the first principles, and actually this is the
wait. But if you do it, if you take it out based on the theory prediction of what it is,
Right.
And it's not, and that's not actually what the actual dependencies in the data is.
You can check what it is in the data. It's trivial to check in the data.
Okay, and you have some, it's, it follows this dependence that
yes.
the theory says
that. It's linear.
Which can make the mass distribution of the jet the same.
Exactly. It's trivial to check this. So you can just check and you can measure the value in the data and you get it and that's what it is.
You can do that same plot with successive cuts.
Sorry, go one more. One, go, you.
So you can do that same plot you have there, but for the data and applying successive cuts.
Exactly.
And you see that the shape does not change
right.
much.
What we there, if you look at this paper, let me see if I have a plot of this in the backup. So we have some.
It would be nice to actually see that.
So this is the actual, this is the plot that you look at. So this is the m over pt squared on the x-axis. You take the logarithm. This is the tau 2 over tau 1. So you can see that there is, so the region of interest is sort of here. And you can see that there is a linear, basically a linear dependence. So you can actually get this, these in data. We have done this in CMS. So if you check, if you actually take this information, now these are actually linear. If we basically decorrelate, it turns out that if you add a log of a PT and some scale mu, these all basically fall on top of each other. So we have no idea what this scale mu is, but we're currently, so Simone Marzani and company are actually trying to calculate this right now. Yeah.
But so the background is linear in this.
Yes.
The signal you have.
The signal is not.
It's very non. So
that's
you're,
right.
You're totally sculpting your signal.
It's not actually that big of a deal. If you look at this before and after, what you're you could in principle do that, but the what you're actually sculpting ends up usually sculpting basically this region way down here for the W mass. For the top mass, it's not an issue because it's everything else is way out. The top and the Higgs are way out here, and the only thing you really are sculpting is sort of the turn on of the W mass, which is not such a big problem. The peak is almost not affected at all.
At PTs of 500 to a TV?
Basically. So you can play with the cuts in order to do this, but the moral of the story is that you can actually decorrelate this. Okay, going back. You can actually decorrelate this in order and use the theory information that's available in order to reduce the systematic uncertainties. So, okay, so there's lots of different things. This is just an example of this general topic, and I think that's the general gist of what I would personally like to see this week, is how can we understand that what we're doing is really the best for the actual analysis and not just best for, some Monte Carlo data versus, or efficiency versus background rejection curve, which may or may not have any bearing on real life. And how can we leverage theory developments and the tremendous amount of work that's going into the QCD of what's going on here, how can we leverage that to use it in clever ways to improve the searches here? So this is just a proof of concept more than the punchline, okay? Okay, so I'm gonna switch topics a little bit to guide discussion for the rest of the week, unless people want to discuss more.
One more thing, this particular case you showed that is true for the n-subjectiness variables,
right.
But how about other...
We took a look at a couple others. We took a look at the C2 and D2 variables. It's the same. It's the exact same story. You can decorrelate them. I think I may have the plots here. Maybe not. Anyway, so we looked at other variables, not just D2, or not just tau 2-1. But the same story applies for all of them. You can, anytime you have some... some mass NPT dependence, it's usually based on a dependence on this rho variable or some transformation of that rho variable. And so effectively this is using the theory and understanding that we've been trying to gathering the past few years and starting to deploy this into the searches and measurements. Okay, any other questions on this? I mean, like I said, this is mostly a proof of concept, just that there is an existence of something that could be improved by theory, by improving the theoretical understanding. This is not the only, it might not even be the best application, it's just one of them. Okay? All right. So I want to also talk about, you know, just in general, I mean, I think this is probably obvious to most people about, but I think it would be remiss if we didn't say anything about the 750 GV excess. Just to be, you know, just to put this into context, now that you're all experts at calculating the angles based on the boost, if you're looking at something that decays into standard model particles or maybe not, these are all the various topologies that you look into. The boost of W and Z bosons from 750 resonances is something in the 4 to 5 range. Higgs bosons is at about 3. Top quarks is about 2. Anything that's and all of those fall into the either fully boosted or marginally boosted categories. And so there's, you know, if this thing turns out to be real, you have to use boosted techniques in order to fully understand what's going on. There's no you just can't get around it. So there's also the possibility that, say, maybe there's some light vector-like quark or some other weird thing that happens. Obviously this will depend on what the masses are, but let's say the mass is lighter than 200, even that will be moderately boosted at the, if you're looking at a wide cone jet, you'll get most of the products for even a light vector-like quark. So this might be something interesting. I mean, I don't know about Atlas, but CMS has very little work done in terms of light vector-like quarks. We have lots of searches for heavy vector-like quarks that are decaying to tops and Ws and Zs and Higgses, but in terms of thinking about light vector-like quarks, there's not a whole lot of work that we've done, but Atlas, I think, may have some.
You mean transitions to light jets?
Yeah.
We had one analysis for run one.
Okay. So this may be something we can think about this week, too. Things that are vector-like quarks, and maybe it is and maybe it isn't boosted, but in any case, it's something it's going to have jetty final states, so it's useful to, it falls under our Block 6 title. Okay. And so in terms of other things that, other analyses that you're interested in, so things like Z gamma, ZZ, and WWW, these all will require a boost. Other things like Higgs plus X and TT bar can benefit. You don't necessarily have to use the boosted techniques, but certainly hadronic techniques will be important. We should also possibly think about any other decays and any other gotchas or caveats that we should be paying attention to. Think something like boosted die taus for this, and it's not necessarily an unsolvable problem, but it's certainly something you have to be aware of if something is going on here, and if this ever couples to maybe Higgs to tau tau, maybe this is a good way to take a look at this. And as I mentioned, we have a CMS analysis with a couple of boosted taus, and I think this is gaining a little bit more popularity now. Something to think about. So I want to make sure that we're not just focusing only on the jets, because there's other pieces of information that may be relevant. Okay, so just in terms of sort of now opening for mostly discussion, basically looking for novel uses. We've been talking about sort of hidden sector remnants this in the last couple of days, so maybe we can think of some ways to apply these techniques in that kind of direction. We also talked yesterday about some emerging massive jets, in some sense, so displaced jets that are massive. Maybe there's some more development of leptons that we can think about, and maybe we can use this, deep learning for any other kind of analyses. Maybe we can think about something like that. Maybe you can use this event grooming at the to calculate MET in some way or improve the MET resolution. Who knows? So this is something we can think about. And that's sort of ideas we can think of for searches. There's an entire idea of using this kind of stuff for precision programs as well. So we've been using substructure techniques for sort of boosted standard model measurements. So both Atlas and CMS have TT bar cross sections in the boosted regime. We also have jet mass measurements, for instance. But what I actually started to think about, and maybe other people have too, is what if we use sort of grooming and substructure techniques for other standard model measurements? So what can you do for, what can you gain from cross sections of non-boosted objects with grooming? You can look at cross sections or maybe even properties like the masses of particles. So what could you do? Maybe you take the top mass for an example. Could you gain anything by looking at the top mass reconstructed with generic jets without any grooming applied, and somehow comparing that to the reconstructing the top mass with grooming applied. Can we have better control over the theoretical uncertainties for that kind of thing? Can we have better control over the experimental uncertainties using that kind of a thing? Is it less pileup resistant or more pileup resistant, or does the jet energy scale make more sense? Or I think these are some questions that we can start to think about. Same thing with the cross sections, and you can look at differential cross sections in all sorts of categories. You can look at that with and without grooming, and I think this is an important thing to start thinking about. But I don't have I haven't thought this through very much, but this is just some off-the-cuff ideas that people may have thought of and or we may want to explore this week, especially given that we have this overlap with the precision workshop here, so we might have some interesting crosstalk. I mean, in general, I think the systematics, just off the cuff, anytime you have some large parton shower uncertainty, you almost certainly could leverage grooming versus non-grooming in order to reduce that kind of uncertainty. And the question is there anything else that we could think of? Maybe we could make some progress on the hadronic recoil for the W mass measurement. Who knows? Something along those lines. So I think these two slides are generally things that I wouldn't mind having answered in the next couple of days. And obviously this is an organic discussion, so people should chime in with what they think is interesting. And if any of these are completely stupid and crazy, then that's also fine. It's just I think they may not be completely stupid and crazy, but we'll see. Yeah.
One standard model thing you haven't mention that comes to mind is just, is there anything to be learned in heavy flavor decays?
Yes, that's a good point. There's one interesting, I have one backup slide about that actually. So you could in principle look at, so one interesting sort of, emergent property of this whole idea, if you look at boosted bottoms, so Higgs to BB bar, you can actually get a very, very pure sample of gluon splitting to BB bar. And so you can actually look at different creation and flavor creation and versus gluon splitting and these kinds of things. If you look at this delta R between the subjets, you can see this CN here is the blue from gluon splitting. And then the other components of other kinds of productions are pretty subdominant. So
what sample can you get of charm? The gluon to charm.
Don't know. It's a good question.
It'd be really interesting to check that our understanding of how gluons fragment to charm and bottom is correct.
Yeah. These are all things that we could in principle. I mean, Pierre Scans has been asking us to unfold this distribution for a couple of years now, which we just never have time to do. This can actually get the B fragmentation pretty nicely. But nobody seems to have. Nobody bites. But I think there are things that can be learned in from boosted topologies in the standard model regime that maybe we haven't thought of just because we haven't had time.
So now you have that, it says double muon tagged.
Yes.
Do you have a sign requirement on that?
That's a good question. I don't remember.
I don't think so. Because the same sign sample is going to be enriched.
Yes.
So you have that knob to turn.
Well, it's a pretty rich set of knobs there because you've got the PT of the muon, you've got the sine of the muon, you've got the displacement, and so you've got actually several different handles you'd want to use if you want to really maximize it.
But I don't think you're ever going to get a pure CC bar sample. But what you can do is you can get a mixed sample and a pure BB bar sample, and statistically get a
sure. As long as both samples are very depleted in ordinary jets. That would be very interesting.
So I think, like I said, people haven't thought about this very much, I would say. And so these kinds of standard model pieces of information that you can get are, I think, very fruitful ground. We can get some information and or apply crosstalk. And obviously, the theory helps out with our understanding as well. I mean, just looking at this, we wouldn't necessarily come up with this idea unless we had done the theory work first to understand what's going on yet.
Yeah.
maybe this is a naive question, but at what level in the analysis chain can you start to use some of these techniques? For example, is it all offline? Can you move it up into the trigger somewhere?
Yeah.
And the thing I'm kind of curious about is, imagine I had a jet that has a definite property. Let's say it has just its two prongs. It has two subjects in it, and that's it. Very clean otherwise. Can I make use of that information at the trigger level somewhere?
Yeah, I think, so we talked about this a little bit yesterday. So I think, so far, if you look at the, so actually I can use this plot to guide discussion a little. So if you look at, say, that the, you know, some angular variable like, tau 2 1, as a function of this is the theory that you would get here. You get this sort of linear regime here, and they are basically linearly related to MNPT, well, M over PT, I should say. So the question is, if you're actually, you know, what we're doing currently on CMS is applying the jet mass in the trigger level to improve our bandwidth, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday. We can get, if we just look at the mass, we can basically lower, say, if you look at, say, an HT trigger plus a massive jet, you can lower the HT threshold by maybe 100 GeV. Now the question is, how much can you get away with here? It depends on how close your HLT reconstruction is to your offline reconstruction. Because since this is so highly correlated, it may not be worth it to cut on something that's very fine at the HLT level, because that difference may get smeared out when you go to the reconstructed level. So it's difficult to say with certainty whether or not we can make a lot of progress there. But at the end of the day, they're very, very, very linearly related with the mass, and so it may or may not be worth pulling into. Now, a couple of ideas that could come along these lines. If you can come up with something that makes, you know, things scale very nicely with PT, you could be able to, maybe you could come up with triggers that exploit this in a nice way. So maybe you want a soft dropped, you know, trigger for your jets.
I think people are maybe coming in for the next session, so we'll probably have to wrap along.
I'm just answering questions at this point.
Yeah, no, but somebody can just come in. There might be another. We don't have to swim after 3.
Yeah, okay. So we are actually starting the discussion sessions now, so blocks 5 and 6.
There's going to be coffee first.
Coffee?
Yes. So we should have. Let's say thanks, Sam, for the presentation.